Dudley, the LS Gamekeeper Tractor Giveaway. It's happening. August 31st is the deadline. Somebody's going to win this thing.
And they're going to get a nice unit.
I wish we could figure out a way to not give it away because no, I have enjoyed using it so much.
Yeah, it's got a belly mower. It's got a bucket on the front. It's got a bucket on the back.
Yep, and there's a tiller attachment that goes with it. So it's a very handy tractor around the camp house. So go to mossyoakgamekeeper.com/giveaway and you can sign up. Seriously, August 31st, somebody's going
to
win it.
I can't wait to tell all my buddies about it. Hopefully I can use it again if one of my friends wins it.
Hi, I'm Jeff Foxworthy and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Gamekeeper Studio as we count down
the days to
turkey
the
season. It won't be long, will it?
Well, I tell you what, it's sure warm enough out there right now.
It just feels great. It feels like the spring is here.
It does.
It feels like May outside.
It does.
I just was driving back from the main office and it said 88 degrees on my windshield.
Record highs today, supposedly.
Red buds are already blooming. Mm-hmm. It's not even March yet.
No, it is. Still February.
So is there a chance we could have another frost? Or another freeze?
Sure.
Oh, it's Mississippi. It could be 20 degrees tomorrow for all we know.
Yeah. It is. Well, look, so the last couple of podcasts, we talked about Osceolas and then we talked about Rios. Mm-hmm. So today we're going to talk about Miriams.
Miriams.
Which is
the mountain turkey.
They're fascinating.
Yeah, they are.
Do you know where they got their name, Lanny?
I was going to shoot from the hip, but it wasn't going to be good.
Yeah. Somebody's last name?
Yeah, we'll learn about that today, I'm sure. It's one of the things that we're going to ask. But before we get started, I've got our producer, Richie, our esteemed producer, who has, he's had all kind of troubles in producing this podcast with microphones and just all sorts of stuff. But the other day, I walked back to his office to do something. And I want to ask, Richie, when I walked in there, did I catch you asleep or were you praying? Because I paused there for a second. I said, he might be praying. His eyes were closed.
He's got a lot to do, so maybe that's what.
And then all of a sudden you jumped and I left. But I wanted to ask, what did I encounter there?
I was in deep meditation.
There you go.
Guys, I think Richie may have sleep apnea.
Let me tell you what Richie did. Hold on. Let me tell you what Richie did this morning. So,
yeah.
We have an office refrigerator and a kitchen, like most offices and most refrigerators. And someone had been using the kitchen after hours last night, doing a couple things in the kitchen and had knocked some things out of the refrigerator and unknowingly had knocked one of our esteemed coworkers. Beverage.
Her Sprite.
Out of the refrigerator. And it was just on the floor this morning. And she was very upset about it and duly so. Had her name on it, labeled properly and everything else. And she so kindly was to send an email out letting everybody know, that what had happened and what had transpired and how it was not kosher. It wasn't. I mean, this is not good. And I agree with her 1,000%. Problem was, I was on a conference call. On a video call, we were working on some seed stuff, so I realized immediately that it was me that had committed this infraction. Yet I didn't have time to get to our fellow coworker instead. But when I did, I came around the corner, and there was Richie in front of her saying, "I did it. Blame it on me."
Yeah,
he took one for the team.
He took one for the team.
When he didn't even do it.
He didn't
do
it.
Do you think he thought he did it? Maybe he has sleep apnea and he could be thinking that he actually did that.
No, I knew I didn't do it.
Yeah, and I knew I did.
I was a team player there.
He's a total team player.
I knew you were a good human.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a solid stand-up human being. What I mean? And it was me, 100% me. So.
I can believe that.
Yeah.
And I believe Richie's a good guy, but I think he's got sleep apnea. Yeah. I think we need to investigate having you tested there, Richie?
Well, you know, our fellow coworker Chris had sleep apnea.
Yeah, we caught him sleeping at his desk.
You could not catch him sleeping. You would hear him sleeping.
Yeah, you would hear him snoring.
You could not catch him.
I took my shoes off a couple times and tried tiptoeing in.
But as soon as he got the sleeping machine, the breathing machine, it never happened again.
It never happened again.
Yeah, well, he got married, and I think all of a sudden that kind of everything took
care of
himself.
Yeah, then he got a breathing sleeping machine because she wasn't putting up with it.
Nah. All right, we love you, Chris.
Sorry. Yeah. Maybe running over on the office talk.
Okay. All right. So let's circle back around. And today we're going to talk about mirrors. We've got a guest that came highly recommended to us, and his name is Dr. Chad Lehman. He's from Blow the horns for him. He's from South Dakota Game and Fish. He's a senior biologist, been there a long time. He's guys, if you can go to YouTube and you can see, he's got roosted turkeys behind
him. He is sitting in a ponderosa pine forest of turkeys right now. I mean, how much more does that? That's cool right there.
Technology.
Well, good afternoon, Chad.
Yeah, welcome to the Gamekeeper Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, look, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a senior wildlife biologist for South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks. My office is in the Black Hills. I'm actually housed in Custer State Park. And I do a lot of research and management of not only wild turkeys, but I also encompass species such as bobcats and bighorn sheep. So my duties include a wide range of different research and management type of work. And so my job day to day one day I can be darting a bighorn sheep, and the next day I can be rocket netting Miriam's turkeys for a research project. So it's a really fun job, and I just don't know what I could, might be doing the next day. So it keeps me on my toes.
Oh my goodness.
Man, yeah, we might need to send Richie to hang out with him for a couple
of
days.
Yeah, you handle a wide range of animals.
That
sounds
like a dream job.
Yeah, it is.
Well, just Google his name and the word Dakota, and there will be just a huge list of stuff that he's been working on.
That's so cool.
Different articles and things. So
Richie perked up over there. I think you want to go to South Dakota.
Being able to dart a bighorn sheep. I mean,
come on.
Yeah.
How cool is that? I mean, that's like a once in a lifetime thing, and you just get to do it.
It's just what we're doing on Tuesdays.
We get to do it all the time. It's a lot of fun.
Well, look, I don't expect you to answer this question when I ask it, but you could maybe nod your head or something. But after you dart a bighorn sheep, and you'll probably put a mask over him to calm him down and all that. Do you take a picture like, hey, look, I got a bighorn sheep here?
I've done that so many times. I've got lots of pictures. So it gets to a point where it's just like, it's just another bighorn and just another number. So yeah, when you first do the first couple, you're like, oh man, I'm going to get lots of photos. And it's like catch and release hunting, right? So you're sitting there with this big ram and you get lots of photos. But then after a while, it's kind of like, well, it's just part of my job. And after you do a few hundred of those, you're kind of like, well, it's just part of the job.
Yep.
So
got to go tranquilize a bighorn sheep today.
Before we leave bighorn, I mean, that kind of caught me by surprise here, but I don't see how those animals make a living up there in those mountains like they do.
Amazing.
Do you guys?
Nature's amazing.
You know, do y'all, are there disease issues with the sheep that are different than what other agencies have to deal with?
Well, I'll be honest with you. You know, bighorn sheep are obviously a really important iconic species throughout the West, and they've got a lot of importance just because of the disease issues that surround them. So, you know, typically bighorn sheep, they would flourish on their own. We would have, you know, many more thousands of bighorns across the West if it wasn't for disease. And that the big time disease that's a major issue is related to pneumonia. So it's a pathogen called Mycoplasma of pneumonia, which is an important disease that can be transferred not only from wild sheep to wild sheep, but it can be transferred from domestic sheep to wild sheep and back and forth. So that's the problem, is trying to keep these sheep healthy enough to survive over the long term. And so that's a lot of the research that we do when we're darting bighorns is focused on testing and sampling for this disease.
Wow. Another question that I've got, and then we'll move on to turkeys. But back at the time when Lewis and Clark came through, that was a long time ago. But from what I read stuff about what they saw, it sounds to me like they were seeing bighorn sheep down in the lower elevations grazing like cattle. Am I interpreting that right?
Yeah, there's been, you know, reports that have been published from some of the first people that came across. Seton once estimated there was over 2 million bighorn sheep across the West. So you can imagine, you know, Lewis and Clark going across the prairies and seeing thousands of sheep in places just all over the place. So they're out in the grasslands, they're in the foothills of the mountains, they're up in the higher elevations. So you can only imagine, you know, compared to hundreds now in a lot of these herds, they would have been thousands, if not over 2 million sheep across the West.
That's just, I would have loved to have seen all that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get back on topic, but let's talk about Merriam's. I'm not sure where to start, but like Rio's, they've got a different gobble. And Richie, have you got a Merriam gobble queued up for us? He does not.
So. He does.
Okay.
Sounds Rio-ish.
It kind of is. Do you still have that Rio?
Yeah, hit through. Hit that Eastern. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Can you hear that? I mean, Chad, have you gotten to come back and hunt Rios and Easterns in your career?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question there's a different frequency. I equate a Merriam's gobble to a higher frequency pitch. It's higher. You know, you can hear it in that open country a lot further away, whereas an Eastern, to me, has got a lower thunderous tone to it than a Merriam's does. And I would say the Rio, to me, kind of sounds like a hybrid of the two, kind of in that middle pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just my observation.
Yeah.
Well, you know more than I do, for sure.
Well, it makes sense what he's saying, too, because I guess I'm going to use a big word here that I don't even know is right to use, but like geospatially, you know, we always talk about they're trying to get on to a spot here in a tree specifically where they can, you know, basically as many hens can hear them as not. Out there, they've developed a more of a high frequency because of the way the mountains are. It's for the sound will travel longer. But
thank you, Mr.
Yeah, that's only used for Dudley. Look at that.
Well, look at that.
So I got a gold star today.
So what else?
Thanks for the lead in, Chad.
No problem. Yeah, he didn't even know what geospatially is.
It is. I was Googling it.
So, you know, where would you like to start kind of explaining a little bit about this bird?
So I think the main thing to take away from the Merriam subspecies is it's the habitats that it lives in, right? So this is a species that evolved in a montane mountain ponderosa pine type habitat. So its range occurs from Arizona, New Mexico in the southwest up through Colorado's its historic range. And it has been reintroduced further north into obviously western South Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana. And where it seems to do very well is in ponderosa pine habitats. So wherever that tree flourishes, like the trees in the backdrop here, that's where you're going to find Merriam's populations that are doing well. Now, we do have Merriam's populations also out on the prairie as well. You know, you guys talked about some of the prairie habitats on Rosebud in Indian Reservation. Some of those other areas, those are also good habitats. They do flourish in some of those riparian cottonwood green ash draws as well. But when you think of Merriam's turkeys, you really think of them, you know, in ponderosa pine habitats. And I think, you know, just we'll probably be comparing them to Rio Grandes and Easterns probably as we go throughout this program. And I think the takeaway message is these animals, these Merriam's turkeys really do well in more open habitats. So a lot of the ponderosa pine that I'm describing is called an open pine savanna. So anybody that's hunted Merriam's turkeys in this open pine savanna will immediately see that you've got big, big open space pine trees with grasslands underneath, and you can see a long ways through that stuff. And so it's definitely an open pine savanna is what they like. Now, they do use some of the other habitats for their various life history traits, but definitely, they're definitely a ponderosa pine bird for sure.
So when I think about Merriam's, I think about those lighter colored tips on their fans. Almost, they're not quite white, but they're, and then when you land, when you get up close to them and you really look at them, some of those feathers, they're almost, they're so fine. They're like eyelashes, this little white, long, elongated. They're beautiful.
Wispy.
Yes. They're just absolutely gorgeous. But it's so in some places in South Dakota, I guess you have Rios and Miriam. So they, perhaps they mix, I guess they have an opportunity.
Yeah. And typically what I tell a hunter, if they're coming to South Dakota, I tell them, if you're going to come, everything west of the Missouri, 99% of the time, it's going to be a Miriam's turkey. If you're east of the Missouri River, 99% of the time, it's going to be an eastern subspecies. Mm-hmm. So what we've done management-wise in the last 20 to 30 years is we've tried to manage for specifically for Miriam's west of the Missouri River and eastern turkey east of the Missouri River. And for those of you in the audience not aware of this, turkeys are native to South Dakota, and the eastern subspecies was the native subspecies to South Dakota. Hmm. And the range typically went from southeastern South Dakota up through a lot of those riparian channels up to the mouth of the Cheyenne River and the Missouri River is where they were last seen. So it gives you an idea of where the you know indigenous range of the birds was before they were extirpated or removed from the landscape in the early 1900s. And then what the state did, turkeys were reintroduced then in 1948 in the Black Hills with Miriam's from New Mexico, and they just took off. Literally within under 4 years, we went from having 25 birds reintroduced to 1,000 turkeys in 4 years.
Wow.
So that gives you a sense of how well Miriam's turkeys can do.
They were
good
busy.
Yeah. Habitat. And then the state subsequently moved those populations into the riparian habitats out on the prairie. And then Rio Grande's, they were reintroduced in the late 50s and 60s for a period of about 5 to 10 years. And they did well in South Central South Dakota. But following that initial reintroduction, Easterns were brought in the early 1990s. And then subsequent to that, everything's been focused on Eastern wild turkey management east of the Missouri River. So we do have, like you guys talk about, we probably have some relict Rio Grande genetics and some of that stuff in South Central South Dakota, but for the most part, you're looking at Miriams or Easterns now.
Wow,
interesting.
They've been busy in South Dakota.
Yeah, they have.
So, do y'all have any? Is it a fair question to ask a population estimates on the Miriams?
So, right now we don't have a really good population estimate. How we do it is we take the harvest data for our Black Hills unit, and that's it's an unlimited harvest there. So that gives us a pretty good correlation with what we call an abundance estimate. And so we do utilize harvest data in a population reconstruction. And right now we're trying to update that data set to get a better estimate. But we typically look at our harvest data for the big units like the Black Hills. And then our other prairie units, you know, our allocations are usually in that range from 25 permits to maybe 150 to 200 permits. Some of our bigger units like Gregory County will have 700 permits. So out on the prairie units, we typically don't have, you know, as many birds, obviously, because we have to limit our harvest. So we use our harvest data to kind of get this pseudo population estimate then. Hmm.
Dudley, you look like you.
I'm thinking, and I like to think about habitat and trees and stuff. But so before they were extirpated, what do you think the habitat differences were, you know, maybe 500 years ago compared to what we're seeing today? You know, I'm talking about, you know, your ponderosa pines, were they thicker, thinner? Was there, you know, more grasses, you know, whatever?
Yep. Well, I'm convinced, and I have no way to prove this, but, you know, the Black Hills is essentially an island of pine trees. And so I think if turkeys could have found enough of a connector from that southeast country up through the Cheyenne River, they would have made it to the Black Hills. They'd have been highly successful. Geographically, they were isolated by these large swaths of prairie. And if you look at historically in South Dakota, obviously, fire was on the landscape, and when you have a lot of fire, that obviously can probably reduce these amount of riparian habitats that you have connecting some of these other bigger places and trees. And if you look at the fire history of the Black Hills, it was a fire return interval of every 15 to 20 years. So you were having fire come through that landscape fairly frequently. And so you would have these trees that would build up and they'd grow, and then they'd get to a point where they're big enough where they could survive a low intensity understory fire. And so you'd get the trees to a certain size where they really weren't being killed by fire. And then all the little trees, of course, were being killed by fire. So, you know, when you're talking a fire return interval of every 15 to 20 years, you're talking, there's a lot of disturbance on the landscape. And so that's obviously good for a lot of animals, and especially turkeys that want this early successional habitat, you know, for nesting and broodering and stuff. So, you know, even though turkeys weren't out there in the late 1800s, early 1900s, I think they would have done very well in the Black Hills.
Okay. Good to know.
Lanny, what about you?
Well, you know, when I think of South Dakota, I think of wind and kind of being cold. So I just wonder.
It's only -8 here at my house right now.
Wow. Good.
You know.
Oh, how would you guys like to come up here and sit up here for a while?
Yeah, there's 90 degrees difference between you and us right now.
Yeah, I would probably die.
Yeah, I wouldn't make it, that's for sure, especially with that wind blowing. I can't handle that. So I just kind of wonder, you know, about what these birds do in the winter to make it.
No, that's a great question, and we get that a lot. And one of the things we really prioritize as a state agency is winter food plots, and not only for turkeys, but obviously for deer and pheasants and other game birds. And so out on the prairie, if the birds aren't on a ranch, a lot of times they'll be in and around ranch feeding operations for cattle operations. Obviously, that's critically important and a tough. We're having a pretty hard winter up here. And so the birds will be associated with those feeding operations on ranches. If they're not on there, they're going to be utilizing some kind of food plot, probably corn or oats that have been left out on the landscape to help maintain their survival over the winter. And in the Black Hills, we've got a different scenario. And I was going to, you know, try and touch on this with habitats with Miriam's turkeys. What they typically feed on in the wintertime is ponderosa pine seed. So that tree right here in the backdrop has a fairly substantial pine cone. And in September and October of each year, these cones open up and there's a winged seed that comes out. And there'll be pine crops that every 3 or 4 years can be phenomenal. And so these things flutter down to the forest floor. And what the turkeys do in the wintertime is essentially scratching the pine duff, and they're feeding on these pine seeds. And that's their primary food source in the ponderosa pine habitats. And so the critical thing with that, though, is if you've got too much snow, typically we find in the literature and in our research, if it's over 9 inches of snow on the ground, they have a tough time digging through that snow and getting to the pine seed on these south slopes. And so that's when it's important to know, okay, if they're not in the pine forest, then they've got to find some other kind of supplemental food. And in the Black Hills, that's probably either going to be somebody's bird feeder or probably a ranch that's feeding operations with cattle. And turkeys can go about 2 weeks without eating before they starve to death, depending on their body condition.
Huh.
And so typically what we see is these southern slopes, if they get enough sunlight and if they're open enough, hopefully they'll be able to utilize that south slope and get to some of that pine seed.
Gosh, they're hardy.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You got to think they're the hardiest species.
That's a lot of work for a little seed like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I probably compare my backyard chickens to turkeys too much.
Yeah.
But it's crazy to think that, you know, they have this perfect diet for your chickens, and then a wild turkey can go 2 weeks without eating, and then most of its diet is just one seed.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
It's just really interesting.
Yeah, they can lose up to 40% of their body weight in 2 to 3 weeks. So yeah, and it depends on the condition of the bird, obviously, going into that. If they're thin going into that, that's not good. It'll be less time. But typically, they can go, basically, and a lot of scientists will tell you this, biologists study turkeys, when it gets like this, when it's 10 below and there's snow, they would actually prefer to sit in a tree most of the day and not move. Because energetically, it's more expensive to get down and burn all those calories when it's that cold looking for food, versus just sitting and using that thermal layer that they got with all those feathers and just hunker down until it warms up. And then you'll see them then start moving. Once you get into that zero and up, then they'll start getting down and they'll start moving for food. But I mean, I've had radio collared birds, you guys, literally sit in one spot for 2 days when it gets like this and they won't move.
I don't blame him.
And that's an adaptation, obviously, for survival. So
yeah, yeah. So were their beards? I might be. You, Bobby might have pulled the wool over my eyes. Will their beards freeze off? Will it get that cold?
Well, it's probably more related to the nutrition. So if it does start breaking and get brittle, they're lacking some kind of nutritional, probably a protein or something in their diet that would help them maintain that beard. But yeah, I've seen that in some birds that are nutritionally deficient, where their beards do break off.
Hmm. Beard rot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Bobby was pulling the wool.
Yeah, well, he did. Pretty, you know, he does a good job of that.
So, the Miriams out there, do they typically, you'll see them in the wintertime, they'll be in giant flocks, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, 100 to 200 birds is quite common in the winter for their wintering flocks. And you'll see, you know, the gobblers typically will be in their obviously their main groups separated from the hens and the jakes. But, you know, I've seen even gobbler flocks, 30, 40 birds in a group out on the forest trying to make a living in the wintertime.
Hmm. Well, so around here in the southeast, and I guess a lot of area east of the Mississippi that's got a lot of tree cover and such, our lowest hole in the bucket, so to speak, is early successional habitat. Mm-hmm. You know, grassy stuff, wildflowers, you know, it's either mowed or trees around here, it seems. What is the lowest hole in the bucket where you are for the Miriams?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that's going to vary depending on where you're at spatially in the state. So one of the other things that we have to deal with in South Dakota is drought. And so a lot of times I think out on the riparian, the prairie habitats out on the prairie, we'll go through drought cycles where a lot of the grasses and forbs are basically gone. I mean, they've been denuded or they're just not growing because we don't have the rainfall. So obviously early successional for those turkeys is critically important. So they don't have the grasses, the forbs and the shrubs that they need to nest and rear their broods. And that's typically what you see during drought out there is their brood numbers are way low. They'll have, you know, one or two poults, you know, per hen, if not fewer, if none. And in the Black Hills, I think the lowest hole in the bucket, if you will, right now is probably going to be winter habitat. And the reason I say that is we just went through a mountain pine beetle epidemic, which is a native insect that kills ponderosa pine trees when they get overstocked. And so we just went through a period of time here where we lost over 600,000 acres of mature ponderosa pine in the Black Hills. And that has significant impacts to these big pine trees that produce pine seeds. And so when you lose that winter food source, I think that's going to obviously be a big important thing for turkeys here. Typically in the Black Hills, we've got a lot of shrubs and grasslands, nice, beautiful meadows, for nesting and for brood rearing, and typically those are in pretty good condition, and so I would say it's probably the winter habitat component is what's most limiting right now for Black Hills. So it kind of depends on where you're at, and I'm sure you guys hear that a lot from biologists that, you know, the spatially is important, and when you're talking about turkey dynamics, population dynamics, and for us, weather is really important as well.
Goodness gracious, when you talk about how cold those winters are out there. Mm.
Right now.
Yeah. So
right now.
You said it's -8.
Yep.
Yeah. So Chad Toxie's joined us, so you might hear a strange voice now asking questions.
Actually, that's a strained voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's, I think he said it -8 degrees there. It's mm-hmm, just incredible. It's just fascinating, these birds. And I'm sure all these landowners, these cattle ranchers, I'm sure that they, the word I'm thinking of, I'm enjoying it, but they probably get some sense of I'm helping by.
It's called satisfaction.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, most of South Dakota is private land, similar to what you guys see in the Southeast. And if we didn't have producers and landowners that were tolerant and wildlife friendly, we wouldn't have the numbers of birds that we have out here without question. Obviously, we do get some years where we could have some increased depredation, and our agency obviously works with those landowners to try and help them either with, you know, fencing or putting netting on hay bales, short stopping them if we need to, those kind of things where we get into some periods of time where, you know, we've definitely got some issues with turkeys coming in and depredating on them. But for the most part, most of the landowners are fantastic to work with. They understand that the birds are there and need that extra food source in the wintertime and are definitely amiable to working with the state agency and then also providing food for those turkeys.
Sure. So I would think that South Dakota, you probably have another level of predators that most states don't have to deal with maybe even some big cats.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So our predator dynamics vary, obviously, again, from prairie to the Black Hills. But typically, you're going to have your similar predators to what you guys have. You know, our nest predators are going to be things like skunks and possums and raccoons, red fox, obviously bobcats and coyotes. But the added apex predator in the Black Hills is the mountain lion. So that's the one you're talking about. We do have the big cat in the Black Hills. We do have lions that do go out on the prairie on rare occasions as well. But yeah, for the most part, we do have to deal with obviously mountain lions in the Black Hills as well.
So Chad, would you tell us how the bird got the name Miriam?
Yeah,
sure. So it's actually, you know, you guys probably understand that taxonomic names are Latin names, right? So if you've got Meleagris gallopavo, that's the genus species, but then the subspecies names like Sylvestris for Easterns, you know, that's kind of comes from the, you know, where the name came from with the coloration and these other names. But Miriami is actually named for Miriam Hart Miriam, which was an old person that worked in the wildlife field. So that's where that name came from. And So a lot of times these names are associated with the name of a person. So that's where that name came from.
Yeah.
Yep. Osceola.
Dudley was
Chief
right.
Osceola.
Yeah.
So it
yeah.
was named, the subspecies was named in 1900 in honor of Clinton Hart Miriam. He was the first chief of the U.S. Biological Survey.
Yep.
And the Eastern, what do you say about Sylvestris?
That's the subspecies name
of Eastern.
The subspecies, yes.
For did Eastern. You know that, Bob?
I did not know that.
I didn't know it either.
Wait a minute.
I didn't know it. Did you know it?
Heck
yeah. I knew you did, Bob. I knew he did too.
Well, Miriam is
we've
on
both what, learned something.
Yeah, that yeah. we did. But Miriam, you know, I just I think it's.
I'm a biology nerd. I'm not.
Well,
to
I mean,
the,
that's
I'm
why
not
I was
to,
taken
I'm
aback.
Not to Dudley's degree, but I'm.
I mean, I've considered myself. A
I'm sniffing his
coat, nerd
I'm sniffing
my whole
his
life. I missed
yeah.
that one somehow.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, back in the old forum days, I had a buddy whose name was Sylvestris.
Nice. And yours was Big Doe, wasn't
no,
it?
No, we're not bringing that up.
Mark that
Bobby would have said we had a football coach named Sylvestris.
Yeah, well, yeah. Okay.
Well, for your audience, you know, people, this is a whole separate discipline in our wildlife science field are these Latin names, you know, taxonomic names. And so they're constantly, you know, trying to come up with, you know, do you want to clump these things or do you want to split them out? And so taxonomy itself is its own discipline in our field. So you could study this we could talk about this for hours and really bore your audience if you want.
Yeah, well,
I'm ready.
I like the idea that somebody was honored that
yes,
they thought enough
too.
About yep. him to say, yep. okay, we're going to name these Miriam.
So yeah, that's what I think. That's pretty cool.
That's not uncommon. And in fact, you know, back in the day, some of these botanists were like, naming plants after their mistress or their wife or whatever, and then they would part ways.
That might
and
be
a, and then try to get
like
the
a Sylvestris in
and
there
then try
somewhere.
To get the name changed. Yeah, there's yeah, a lot of drama in scientific names for sure.
Oh yeah, I thought it was always so cool when I guess I was right and Dudley was teaching us most of the stuff, but we learned as we both have a complete total obsession with hybrid oaks, mm-hmm. but. Typically, who discovers them and reports it first, basically, can then name it, right, Dudley?
I think it has become a little bit more, I guess the rules have gotten a little
and
tighter.
Like who's keeping the rule book?
That's the odd thing. No, nobody really
yeah.
knows.
It's like Wikipedia.
Yeah, we need to get my buddy.
Nobody.
We need to get my buddy Ryan Russell on here one time to discuss that because he knows a lot about it.
politics.
That sounds fascinating. So, Chad, can we go back? Let me ask you this. You mentioned earlier that they were extirpated.
Yes.
What ended up happening there?
That sounds
what,
like something you take medicine for.
It does, doesn't it? What happened and caused that?
Well, you know, a lot of it's just based from earlier records, but obviously market hunting. Basically, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we didn't have, you know, conservation ethics, right? We didn't have regulations that would say, hey, turkey hunter, you need to only go shoot one. What these people did is when they came onto the landscape, they were trying to feed families and survive. So they were killing things not only to eat it, to live and support their families, but they were selling them, obviously, to support their families. Mm-hmm. So it was market hunting. Probably some habitat things were going on out there that led to their demise as well. But, you know, this is really common, not only for turkeys, but for a lot of species. Elk, for instance, bighorn sheep. A lot of these animals basically were eliminated from the landscape back in these early 1900s. And so before we had the land ethic, the conservation ethic, you know, to right around the 1930s and 40s when we decided, hey, we need to try and bring conservation back to the table here and try and bring these species back from extinction. And so that was the kind of the mindset behind that then. So I think a lot of it, just looking at our earlier records, would have probably just been, you know, obviously killing too many birds to support what was out on the ground. So market hunting.
Yeah. I think he's right. I think there were a lot of things that fell by the wayside there. Everybody's trying to, they were making money off these animals and they were, you know, feeding families and whatnot. And there was just no concern about whether they're going
to
be anymore.
You were living day to day back then.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank goodness for, you know,
Walmart.
You know, and I think Teddy Roosevelt is the guy.
I was fixing to say thank goodness for Teddy Roosevelt.
And
Dudley said Walmart.
I think Dudley had an edible before we got in here or something. I don't know. So
chocolate bar, cookies.
But I've recently been reading about Teddy Roosevelt, you know, designating Yellowstone as a first national park.
Found that out.
Well, no, I knew that. But I've been reading about it
too much.
But he's, you know, what a vision for him to
Mr.
be able to
say.
Hey, you're exactly right, Bobby. I mean, where we are is the only place this stuff happens. It really is. So we're very blessed for the game and fish departments in all the states and what people had the foresight to put some of these rules and laws and funding in place.
All kidding aside, so proud of when we first started television in the early 1990s, and the research was there to prove it. And so the anti-hunting community was just terrorizing hunters, and you know, animal rights groups, send me money, we're free, you know. And so the point was, if you have money and you love animals and you want to donate money to some organization, that is the highest percentage of that money will go to work for animals,
for the animals,
buy a hunting license.
That's right.
And it would just make them insane to hear that, but it's the truth.
It's true. That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Super cool.
Yeah, I see Chad nodding his head.
It's absolutely the truth,
right?
So
I mean,
you know, it's an uphill battle to pick apart what happens in wildlife conservation and the management. Because you know what? We only get to hunt. Look, the bad ones do whatever, but that's not what we're talking about.
No, it's not.
We only get to hunt as part of that plan. And it's just worked out brilliantly for our country.
You know, I think the point you guys are making here is critically important. And 99% of my research comes from Pittman and Robinson funding.
It's
essentially a tax on ammunition and guns. And those monies come back to the states in the form of doing research and management of habitats. So without those funds, you guys, we wouldn't be in the place where we're at right now with a lot of these game species. And I'm glad you guys brought that up, because, you know, 99% of the funding for this, you know, turkey studies that I do, the bighorn sheep work that I do, come from that pot of money. So it's critically important that our public understands that.
No doubt about it.
Oh, it's everything.
It makes you proud, because basically hunters are saying, hey, we'll take care of our
exactly
own.
Words I was just going to say. Oh, you hear us crowing and preaching, and I know I'm on my soapbox sometimes about, you know, hunt to what your place will bear. You know, don't just shoot. But I'm telling you, when the word gets out and hunters, most, almost all of them, everybody's willing to pitch in and do whatever it takes for our wildlife to prosper. They really, really are. And I 100%. Think the biggest thing is just lack of knowledge of what to do and how to do it and so forth. But it's crazy to see that just take off in the last 5 to 10 years in what we do. And people that love to hunt and fish are just dying to help out. Yeah. Really are. They really are.
So Chad, I want to ask a couple of questions. The Miriam, if you compare it to the Rio or the Eastern, is it a bigger bodied bird? Is its head a little smaller? Looking at photographs and whatnot, is the spurs? What are the physical differences?
No, there's definitely physical differences. I get that question a lot, and I've had my hands obviously on Eastern turkeys east of the Missouri. Miriam's out here, and there's no question they're a shorter bird, stockier bird. Yep. The average weight on our gobblers is about 18 pounds in the Black Hills. And if you compare that to our Easterns, typically they're going to be in the low 20s, 20 to 22 pounds for an average weight on an Eastern gobbler that's 2+ years of age. And so they're definitely a little bit smaller. They're definitely shorter and stockier. You know, you get your hand on an Eastern, the one thing you really notice when you look at them is the length, how long they are, how athletic they are. And a Miriam's is definitely a kind of a shorter, boxier, heavy set bird. So there's definitely a difference there in their body build for sure.
I'll tell you one thing they have the biggest feet of all of them.
Is that right?
And it has to be because of being in living in rocks and stuff. I don't know why their feet, their toes
got to hold
are
on
so
in
big
the wind
and swollen
too.
And thick compared to the Eastern turkeys. Way bigger feet. They really do.
I don't think they have as thick or heavy of a beard either.
Well, they don't. They have shorter beards. And I was wondering if that's genetic or rocks or, you know.
I think it's probably related to the habitats they live in. I think we do see some Miriams out on the prairie when they get in to some pretty good food, they can grow some big beards. So I think that's more driven by the habitats they're in. Right. You know, when you're in a dry, you know, almost desert type environment, and you're trying to make it on ponderosa pine seed, you're probably not going to have as healthy of a beard as you would, you know, an Eastern turkey that's in Eastern South Dakota that's living high in the hog on, you know,
beans,
corn food plots and acorns. Right. And I think a lot of that's just driven more by the food they eat.
Yeah.
I will say the ones that just take your breath, beards and all, come from major deep topsoil ag places.
No doubt about it.
Missouri, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana.
Yeah.
Places like that.
But to flip that, I think you're talking about taking your breath away. When you see a big Miriam strutting and they've got those beautiful white tips on,
honestly,
they are gorgeous.
It's sacrilegious to say one is most beautiful. But boy, I've looked at them and said, that's the most beautiful of all the species. But it's just, you know, I don't want to compare that because they are all just an unbelievable work of art. Yeah. Like nothing in nature.
No doubt. We love them all.
Yep.
So Chad, you probably, as you got ready to come on this podcast, you said, well, if these knuckleheads are got any kind of smarts, they'll ask me this. Well, is there something that we hadn't asked we need to ask?
Well, I think if a turkey hunter's coming out to South Dakota, I think you got to, you know, obviously do your research. You know, there's lots of private land opportunities. If you want to knock on doors, go with an outfitter, obviously there's those opportunities. There's obviously some public land opportunities as well. We do have a really good walk-in program, which is a lease program that we pay private landowners to allow public hunting access. There's lots of that available.
That's awesome.
And then, of course, you've got a lot in the West. We've got the Black Hills, which is almost 1 million acres of public land that's owned by you and I and all the other taxpayers that's available for folks to utilize. And I encourage people to do some research, look at what you want to do, and you can come out. The Black Hills tag is an over-the-counter tag. So that's, you can go online, go to our website, get this license, and you can come and hunt. And if you're going to come to the Black Hills, I always tell hunters, if you're going to hunt, you're going to want from south to north, the gradient of bird densities changes. So in the southern Black Hills, we don't get the tough winters that they get in the northern hills. There's going to be more turkeys. Central Black Hills, there's going to be moderate amounts of turkeys. And then in the northern hills, there's fewer turkeys because of the tough weather up there, but there's still good hunting opportunities. And I always tell the hunters, so if you come to the southern Black Hills, expect there to be more hunters too, because obviously the hunter trend follows the turkey density trend. So there's going to be more hunters in the south, and that carries through as well. But there's lots of opportunities here for people to come and hunt. And I just encourage people to, you know, investigate South Dakota, investigate also the other states of the West. Obviously, we've got Merriam's turkeys in Montana, Wyoming, all the way to the southeast. So there's plenty of opportunities there. And I encourage people to go do a new experience. So if you've been hunting eastern turkeys and you're like, man, I just want to get in the car and go try something new, there's nothing better than coming out to the West and experiencing a new hunt. It is so much fun. And I always look forward to doing that one in my own personal hunting. I love going to new states and see and having new experiences. So I think that's the last thing I'll bring up with related to hunting Merriam's turkeys is keep an open mind and be welcome to new experiences.
So I did that exact thing, cuz and I both. And we went to some kind of National Wild Turkey Federation hunt that they invited us to. This would have been, gosh, late 80s, early 90s, a long time ago. And they had all their special guests, and we didn't have a place to go. So we literally went to some check state. We obviously bought our license first, but we bought some check station place for the Black Hills and got a pamphlet and a map. And we had a rental car, just a car, and we're riding through the Black Hills.
Car.
Yeah. And yeah, no, no, unfortunately the tube car, but, it worked, but we went and we went and we went and we're like, you know, you just had to get your, you know what? We're getting to sightsee a beautiful place.
Oh yeah.
And here's a little side trail and let's just park it and walk down here. And this was after just about a whole day. And then lo and behold, we hear a hen yelp. I was like, and he was like, oh, that's all we get. And I was like, that's awesome.
A turkey.
After what we've been through, that's awesome. Sit down. We yelp, hen yelps, turkey gobbles. 2 minutes later, I kill one.
Golly.
And that was it. That's all we heard. And then when I shot, like, three gobbled. And we moved 100 yards. And then probably 30 minutes later, he killed one too. And that was in a rental car, just taking potluck, taking a pamphlet map. Yeah. And it
that's
was
fun.
It was my point in telling him this is reiterating what he said.
Yeah.
It was just a great experience. I think it was going to be a great experience either way, just to go do something like that. But, yeah. Haven't pulled it out. And actually, he filmed it. It was on Primos. He filmed me, and then he gave me the camera, and I actually filmed him. And Primos used his hunt instead of mine. I got a videographer attaboy. I had to relive that memory with him because the Black Hills is really a special place.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, nice. All right, Matt, get us a rental car.
I need a pen. Yeah, well,
Mount Rushmore's in South Dakota.
We took them to take pictures where you could see the Mount Rushmore in the background.
Oh, that's great. I never heard that story. I thought your stories.
It's recorded on videotape.
I heard overheard Cuz telling a story. It may have been from that hunt, but it had something to do with the vocalizations of the Merriam's turkeys. And he was trying to call in the way he calls here in the South to Easterns. And I don't know if it was a guide or a friend mentioned something about, you know, changing the way you call a little bit and gave him some tips, and it immediately worked. Can you get into that a little bit?
Oh, I think you guys have opened up a can of worms. That's really important. And I think a lot of hunters that are used to hunting in Eastern Turkey are going to have to change their tactics quite a bit, because the home range size of these birds is probably 4 to 5 times at least bigger than you might expect in an Eastern turkey. So these animals are covering some large distances. So I think if you get a bird that's working, you got to understand first and foremost, it's in a really open habitat. So their voices are traveling a long way. So it's probably further than you might think it might be if you're, for instance, down in the southeast where you've got that dense vegetation and you can't hear them very far. And so you've got to kind of gauge, you know, the distance from where you're hearing that bird. And then, you know, when you're calling at them, and then you've also got to be available to get up and go. And by that, I mean, you've got to be willing to move. I think a lot of guys make the mistake of They just sit and they think, okay, I'm in a good spot. I'm going to just wait them out. And that can work. But, you know, this bird, if you've got a gobbler with a harem of hens and they're going down a ridge, they could be 4 or 5 miles away from you by the end of the day. And so that just gives you a sense of how far these animals can move. And so you got to be willing to be really mobile and move on them, probably a lot more so than you would on an eastern turkey. I hunted in the southeast with a good friend of mine that hunted eastern turkeys, and I was always amazed at how patient he was. Like, he would tell me to sit down all the time and just wait. And I was used to hunting Miriams and running and gunning, and I wanted to get up and move. And one time I got a quick funny story. When we first got there, we were hunting in Tennessee on Land Between the Lakes. And this bird, the first Eastern that I heard gobble, I'll still remember it to this day. It was so cool hearing that thunder. And I'm like, we got to go. And he goes, you need to sit down.
he was right, I bet, too.
He goes, that bird is probably under 100 yards. And I would have thought it would have been, you know, a half mile away. It was so funny. And he was training me on how to gauge eastern turkeys and hearing them in that dense forest. And so that's just a nice little anecdote about mm-hmm. the differences between honey eastern and Merriam's turkey.
One of Mr. Fox's rules when I was a kid, he always used to say, if he's close enough to answer you, he's close enough to sit down and call. And I know that drives some people crazy, but that was his saying about the turkeys we grew up hunting in the deep south. Mm-hmm. If he'll answer you, you need to stay put. You can call him from where you are.
Interesting. And then I know, you know, this is a Merriam's conversation, but you do have Easterns in the eastern half of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Have you ever noticed any difference in do the Easterns, are they henned up at the exact same time that the Merriam's are?
When's the rut? Question. When's the rut stagger?
Yeah. Does the rut stagger. Good layman's terms.
Yeah, that's right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So our peak incubation typically in South Dakota is going to be around May 10th through May 20th. And so that's that rut you're talking about where the birds are starting to really nest. And then you've got the gobblers that are starting to amp up the gobbling a little bit more, right?
Okay.
And so I would say, you know, we probably don't see too much differences between the Easterns and the Merriams from a standpoint of, you know, they're going to be walking around with their harems. They're going to have their groups of mobile hens that they're following around. And the trick to it's timing it. And you guys know this as turkey hunters is trying to find that gobbler that you can either break away from that group of hens or that essentially they've left and now they're searching. And that's that time period where you're like, you got that gobbler that will come to that call. You know what I mean? And so there's always those breaks throughout the turkey season where you're trying to find that window. That's critically important when you're calling at them.
So not,
but
not
you know,
much.
our in the West, our turkey seasons start well before, you know, peak incubation. And we're trying to adjust. We've actually adjusted the Black Hills. Our seasons typically open the second Saturday in April. And we've actually moved the Black Hills season now to the fourth Saturday in April.
Good for you.
We're still not, I'm trying to get us to that peak incubation. I wanted to get a May 1st start date. We're getting closer. We're not there yet, but I think we're going to hopefully get to that point where we get to that.
That's great. Right.
Yeah, that's important.
I guess you'll be collecting data the whole way just to try to compare.
Correct.
What works
Absolutely.
Better with the population.
You know, visiting with you and experts on Osceolas too, Rios, just curious, especially in your world, the Rio mixing with an Eastern, a lot of times that's kind of similar terrain and maybe it's brushier, but you're talking about more of a quote unquote mountainous bird. And so I'm just wondering if you see any places where Eastern's habitat, inhabit successfully like mountainous kind of traditional Merriam terrain. Because that would be really unique if that happened, or they just go stick to river bottoms, big timber, and all that.
Oh, I always think, you know, how cool would it have been if we would have had enough of a habitat continuity between the Black Hills and that Missouri River drainage, and Easterns would have made it. Could you imagine, you know, if we would have had Easterns?
I guess that's what I was asking. Evidently, they didn't.
And I my theory is I think they probably would have been just fine. I think, you know, turkeys in South Dakota were successful in that prairie habitat. I think they would have been successful. And it turned out to be just fine. You know, we do have primarily ponderosa pine in the Black Hills. So I think having Merriam's there is a good fit, obviously. But I also think our Easterns probably would have been just fine there as well. And we've got a lot of country, particularly in the South Central part of the state, where we've got a lot of rolling hills, some steep topography that our Easterns are doing just fine in. That Prairie Coteau up in the Northeast, up in Marshall and Roberts County's got a lot of that rolling, steep rolling hills and burr oak habitat, and they're doing really well up in that stuff.
Good to know.
Clearly the elite thing to chase for our crowd and our following and the people we serve in turkey hunters is the, you know, forever it's been the Osceola because it's hard to get. It's mostly private lands. There's a few public places and all too. And then it's gotten expensive because it was constricted area and all that. But then more and more is the pure Merriam, you know, the Snow White. That's getting to be such a big deal to people too. And, you know, it sounds like you've got an area that they don't, you know, they don't have anything, kind of, I hate to say, tainting them by, you know, hybridizing with a Eastern a Rio or something. Sounds like you got a big consolidated area of pure Merriams up there.
Yep. I think if you come out to South Dakota and you're willing to look in anywhere from the Missouri River west, you're going to 99% of the time, if you're going to go hunt a bird, you're going to find that white tipped, that coloration that you're talking about there.
So beautiful.
Yeah, they are.
And there's just something about that white tip that you see when they come to that full tail fan. That I think that's what a lot of guys notice first thing. They're like, holy cow, look at that bird. Sitting there with those white tips.
Well, it's just such a feathery white that looks like snow. It literally looks like snow. It's just, and mixed with all, still the same, most of the same, just iridescent, incredible colors of all our turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty special.
It is. It is. So, Lanny, have you got another question? Or
I always like to talk about eating turkeys. Talk about hunting turkeys. You got a favorite way to eat wild turkey?
Well, I'll tell you, my favorite way, and it's been this way a long time, is I like to put them on the grill. I'll do a little bit of a marinade, but then I'll take the breast meat and I'll wrap them in bacon, toothpick them, and I'll put them on the grill and barbecue them that way to keep the juice in there. Mm-hmm. I love that flavor, but if you let it cook at its own devices, you know, it will lose its juiciness. So I like to wrap them in bacon and cook it slow on the grill. And man, I'll just pull that out and put it on the plate. And I just love eating them that way. That's my favorite.
Nice.
That's good. That's the first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Banana peppers are good on them too.
Oh, like that. Yeah. See, you get your vegetables.
But what about you, Mac? What you got?
I do have one question about their roosting. I mean, around here, I mean, we look for water sources, creeks, streams, rivers. Where do you find that Merriam? I mean, do they have historic roost sites? I know traveling large distances, they might not make it all the way back to that same tree the next day. So what do you look for roost locations?
No, that's a phenomenal question. And I tell guys to look for this characteristic when they're scouting. What they like to do in the Black Hills is they want trees that have 3 to 4 feet spacing between the branches. So they're typically going to pick a big tree. So we're talking 10 to 12 inch diameter breast height. So that's a big tree with really wide spacing between the branches. They don't like the bushy trees so much because it's hard to fly up in there and maneuver into those branches. So if you can find those roost trees, that roost characteristic where they've got these bigger open space trees, that's typically where they're going to roost. And you're absolutely right. You know, they'll move 4 or 5 miles. So they're going to try and find that characteristic in the next ridge or the next place they land. So, but a lot of times, you know, you'll be walking through the forest and you'll see these old roost sites. You'll see the droppings below the trees and you'll look up and you go, oh, yep, that's the characteristic that I need to find for a roost tree.
Can you send us a couple of pins on Onyx of some examples of those that we could look
just
at?
Little roosting areas. Just a couple.
Yeah.
Big deal.
That's funny.
So look, Chad, we've got it. But look, you've been very patient. You've answered a bunch of our questions. I'm looking at Toxie. Toxie, if another question bubbles up, raise your hand and we'll get to him. But
I'll just interrupt.
It's like around the dinner table here. But Dudley, I want to get to your rapid fire.
I could ask questions all day.
Yeah, why don't you tee it up with him?
All right, so Chad, we do this every week with our guests, just kind of to get to know you better. And it's a lot of fun. So we just want you to answer the questions pretty quickly. You can say neither or both or something if you need to punt on one or a couple. But anyway, are you ready?
So this is rapid fire, and it's brought to you by our friends at
Springfield Armor.
That's right. That's right. And they make that. Hey, Chad, I bet some of those game wardens up there carry some 1911s on their hips out there patrolling us the badlands of South Dakota. You know,
they probably do. Yep.
Yep. Hey, look, now hang on, because once we get finished with this, Max got a trivia question for you that's going. Well, we'll get to see what you know here first.
I bet he gets it right.
Oh boy. Okay, I'm in the hot seat.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Oatmeal or grits?
Oatmeal.
Peanuts. Roasted or boiled?
Roasted.
Is it a Coke, a pop, or a soda?
Pop.
Would you rather hunt the first 3 hours of the morning or hunt from 10 to 2?
First 3 hours.
If you could only yelp or cut for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Yelp.
Choose one, owl hoot or crow call?
Crow call.
Ribeye or filet?
Ribeye.
Travel to hunt or homeboy?
Oh, travel for sure.
Okay, this is important. Natural toilet paper or BYOTP?
Oh, man. Both.
That was good. Yeah,
that was really good. Was good.
Sorry about that, Jay.
I'm not done.
Oh, wait.
Would you rather hunt Easterns or Miriams?
I'm going to go Eastern because I live with Miriams. So.
There you go.
Cool story, bro.
Good job.
So I have to say, quick, in the annals of Mossy Oak and way back in time, so many things originated from our great friend Bob Dixon, but obviously it made me think about it. We had a place where we all hunted together, and someone was like, I saw one of those cotton gloves laying in the road. He said, don't touch it. Whatever you do, don't touch it.
Yeah, if you ever see a camo glove in the woods, do not pick it up.
So, Chad, next we're going to ask you a trivia question. And if you get it right, then one of our listeners that's left a review wins a prize. And Lanny, we've got a new prize table over here. If you'll see, Richie, Richie will be showing the prize here in a second. But this puts a lot of pressure on you, Chad, because if you don't get it right, then. Well, we just don't know what happened.
I apologize for him, Chad. He is the worst.
I'm already feeling bad about going to get this wrong here. I'm in the hot seat again.
He loves to watch people squirm. I've never seen anything like it.
All right, Max, yours.
Here we go.
All right, Chad, you're playing for Bracy Clark, who left us a review. The prize is a Winchester floor rug that came out of the Gamekeeper closet.
Yeah, Richie, would you show us? All right, I want you guys to see.
We got to add some biologic T-shirts to this mix, too.
Richie Vanna White.
It's the iconic Winchester dude on a horse. Yeah, I love it.
So I'm just taking this opportunity to clean out the closet.
Oh, my God.
All right. So the question is, we all know that pronghorn babies are very small and delicate when they're born. True or false? They have to stay hidden for up to a week before they can become mobile.
True.
So read him the answer that we had.
So what the caveat to that is, though, is what's their hiding strategy, right? So we know they can get up and walk, but is the strategy better to hide for the first week or get up and run? Right.
Yeah. And I think you're nailing it, but we may have worded the question.
Of course, it's a trick question.
Yeah.
Well, of course, as I said, I warned you about them.
So
I've done pronghorn research, and I know they can get up and run and walk and
yeah, you're arguing with the South Dakota hey, senior Bobby, biologist. I just want you to know that.
You read the research by one of his students.
How many pronghorns have you messed with?
Well, so, Mac, will you read what we had? Okay, I think this will explain it.
So baby pronghorns might take their first fumbling steps as soon as 30 minutes after birth. They can already outpace humans at just 4 days old, and by the time they're a week old, they can outrun horses. Pronghorn calves are milk fed exclusively by their moms until they reach 4 to 5 months of age.
So you did not ask the question right whatsoever.
So you asked a pronghorn researcher who lives in South
Dakota.
You're
going to argue with him about that.
No, I wasn't going to argue. But I found it fascinating that within 30 minutes that they're walking around, and within a few days they could outrun you, Lanny.
I doubt about it.
But they know better.
That's correct.
So there's really no right answer.
I'm going to bet you our white-tailed deer are very similar.
I bet they too.
I would ask you this. Instead of that question, one of the things that I've learned over the years, like all our biologists or game wardens, everybody, if you see a phone, don't touch it. Whatever you do, don't touch it. Well, mom went there, she's there just, but they're like invisible odor wise for some period of time. I don't know if it's there. Correct. Is that true of pronghorns too?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, they've definitely, the first couple days after mom licks off all of that amniotic fluid, they definitely don't have the scent that they will get when they're at a week or 2 weeks of age. So they definitely rely on that hiding strategy for sure the first week to avoid predation. Because even though they can get up and run the first couple of days, if you get a pack of coyotes coming in to hunt that thing, they're better off just sitting still and not moving, hoping that they don't find them.
Mm-hmm. No trouble.
And the mom's typically not right by their biome. The mom tries to lead the predators away from where that fawn is hiding.
Yeah, she don't want her scent to draw something to them. It's just nature. Yep. I mean, at every turn, at every podcast, at every biologist we talk to, nature is so amazing. It never gets boring. It's the most fascinating thing in life. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Let's just say you were correct.
Yeah.
And Bryce Bobby.
Bobby read it wrong.
Bobby gets to go to timeout.
Yeah. Bryce and Clark, you've won this great rug.
I would say, double his prize.
Yeah, we got to throw some biologic t-shirts in there for sure.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, look, Toxie, you didn't get to hear, but at the very beginning, he kind of told us his job description. And one day he's dart gunning a bighorn sheep. The next day he's trapping turkeys with a cannonette. He's just handling all sorts of animals.
We've got to send Richie out there to hang out with him for a couple of days. Mm-hmm.
He's got a dream job.
He does. That's incredible. And thank you. I just decided we're going to start something here at Gamekeepers and at Mossy Oak that I see us all do. Whenever we run into a veteran, we always say, thank you for your service. From now on, with people like you, I want to say sincerely from my heart, thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Oh,
thank
that's
you.
Great.
Yes, sir.
No, I appreciate it, guys. I appreciate what you guys are doing and disseminating this information from my world, my realm, and in research and management out to the public. Because without your guys's platform, we're not getting this information out to everybody. And I think this is the kind of thing that should be done all the time. And I really appreciate what you guys are doing as well. Appreciate your service as well.
There we go.
Yeah. There you go.
Dudley has this little segment called Ask Dudley, and where a listener asks him a question, he answers it. I'm going to turn it over to you, Dud.
So, again, this is not really from a specific listener, but I'm just basing this off of, getting questions, folks emailing me and talking to me on the phone. Folks are wanting to know tips for scouting for turkeys early season. And I've been out I call it my Sunday afternoon stroll. I've been out, scouting the last couple of Sundays. And what I'm noticing, at least in our area, is a lack of acorns this past fall and winter. And, you might be 100 miles away and just had a crazy big bumper crop. But around here, we did not. And the tip I have, if you're scouting, the Easterns around here, I know, are keying in on acorns. There's not a lot of insects. There's not a lot of green stuff to eat. So they're going to be scratching around. And this year, I'm noticing that all the cherry bark red oaks and the southern red oaks are basically the only game in town, at least in my area. And so I challenge you guys to start learning your oak trees. So if you look on the ground and you see a bunch of scratching, don't just say that this is a good food source and move on. Try to figure out what kind of tree it is. And that way you might can save it on your own X on your phone and, come back and look for other trees. But if you know that the cherry barks are dropping and the southern reds, and you know the site relationship that they're usually going to be in the drainages and the lower slopes, you can look on your phone at a topo map and find similar areas that look exactly the same, same elevation, same aspect, and go find more cherry barks and more southern reds to check for early season before things green up a lot.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
So, and that's going to help you on years. You know, if there's acorns everywhere, it's harder to narrow it down. But on a light year, you can be really successful hunting near food sources just because there's not that much food around. So,
thank you, Mr. Know-It-All.
Well, that was good. Thank you, Dudley. Well, guys, look, we had Dr. Chad Lehman. And I still see him sitting there. South Dakota Game and Fish. He's a senior biologist. We really enjoyed talking to you, Chad. And we'd love for you, if you ever get a chance to come down this part of the world, look us up. And we can't promise you a turkey, but we might. We can talk about it.
We can try.
Bobby will take you to his favorite lease every time.
Yeah.
We might trade some.
I'm sure it'd be a great experience no matter what.
I tell you what Bobby will do.
We don't have many hills to climb, so you'll be good there.
No, we don't.
Bobby is a sneaky good fisherman, and he has a sneaky spots. He might even tell us where he hunts, but he will never reveal a hot fishing hole to us.
Well, bring your fishing pole. Yeah.
Love to have you.
Chad, we enjoyed it. We sure did.
Very much.
We'll stay in touch with you, and if you need anything from us, you be sure and holler at us.
Okay.
Keep hatching those turkeys.
That's right.
Yeah, we're going to try.
Yeah, that's right. Good deal. Thank you.
Take care.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks, Chad.
All right, guys. Did we learn anything?
Always.
Always.
We learned a lot. Yep. I've got more questions, but, the show must go on. We got other things to do.
Yeah, one thing we did learn is, there's no perfect answer to a lot of these things.
It depends.
One says sitting still in patience, and the other one says move, move, move. Mm-hmm. Just depending on where they are. So, mm-hmm. It just goes to show you develop your own. Listen to everybody, soak it all up, be your own man, develop your own way of doing things, based on where you are.
It was interesting to hear him say how the Miriams and those ponderosa pines were synonymous with each
other.
Yeah,
I found that really interesting. And just, what he's saying, how it relates to the turkey restoration efforts, and how they got there is really interesting. And it's interesting to admit there's a hard line there between the Easterns and the Miriams.
Well, right? I was in pure Miriam country last spring in northern New Mexico, and they hadn't had a hatch in years now. It was bad. And they blame it on they've had such drought conditions at the wrong times. They aren't. And they said their primary source is the pine nuts. I had no idea.
That's what he was talking
critical.
About. That
critical. But in their world, it is. And so without them, they don't have nutrition to even have good hatches.
Yeah.
Pinons.
Mm-hmm. Pinons.
Exactly.
So I'm trying to think when this one, there's going to be one more event for the Mr. Fox Fest. Is it March 11th? They'll be here at the West Point Mossy Oak store.
And we may or may not have a short one. We'll talk about that.
Uh-oh.
Because things are really looming to be big. I've never seen anything like it. All I can say with this podcast, which will be prior to our event in West Point, is that we are just can't – there's no words for the gratitude we have for the love of Mossy Oak and the brand and my dad.
No doubt.
And what he stands for, because everybody here knows it's just so pure and all, but it's like it is absolutely – we way underestimated what kind of response there would be. I mean, you just don't know until you do something. No. And so at any rate, to everybody that is out there that – has responded or let us know or in whatever form, waiting in line for stuff and all. It's just crazy. And we just know, no matter what anybody says, anywhere on the planet, we are so grateful for that love, because let's just face it, that's what I say all the time. Love, at the end of our run, love's all we got. And when we get that kind of love from that many people, it just makes our life awesome here. Mm.
Well, so the Fox Vest in and of itself is incredible. You know, there was one auctioned at the end of it, went for, but there were also, I think, there were about 10 really.
A world-class one of collection a kind of calls. Custom calls.
Yeah. Wait, you know. Calls that normally you'd be on a wait list 2 to 5 years to get. Yeah. Yep.
We looked at them today.
They did that, and all those are going to be donated to charity. And we're actually found out that we're donating a lot of them to charity for auctions, for raffles, for places. Mm-hmm. You know, there's got to be a limit to it. We just can't do it all over the place. But sure. Had no idea the outpouring of response to it. And he loves it too.
Yeah, he does.
He loves it.
Dudley, you got anything to add?
No, I was just really interested that the man that was the high bidder on the vest used to work at Biologic in the warehouse time ago.
His stepdad was actually overall the leasing for International Paper, their wildlife division, whatever, when we were leasing land from them.
Portland Landing.
Yeah, Small World. Sir. So we knew him from 25 years ago.
Just Jimmy Bullitt. Great guy.
Coincidence. Crazy.
Yeah.
But a prince of a guy.
Oh my God!
Oh man, yes. Great family, yes. No doubt about it.
Yeah, and Dudley, he was in the marketing department.
Oh,
he
I'm was, sorry, he was an intern. I didn't get the full story.
Yeah, he's a really smart young man. So we taught him all we knew, Lanny.
I know, and he did something with it.
He did something.
And he was on top of what y'all taught him. He was able to
succeed. We didn't hold him back.
He was able to succeed anyway.
Well, that's good. Mike, you got anything to add?
He's over there booking a trip to South Dakota, it looks like. Yeah,
sounds like I got good odds based on the guy buying the Fox Vest that we're all to.
Yeah. So. As spring approaches, I might get harder for them to corral up in here.
Oh,
to
the look, studio. I'm glad we're packing. This is the third one this week, by the way. Yeah. Oh,
so, but hey, just
you better get them in, buddy, because if you starting, do get them in, it's going to be starry-eyed up in
on
here.
On my trail cams, a couple of places I see in the strutter, there's flowers blooming in my yard. Wood ducks are starting to nest. I mean, it's happening. The season of rebirth is happening. We had Ash Wednesday at the church last night. It's the most special season there is. So please get out there and, you know, connect with all this stuff God gave us and cherish it. You only get so many springs. It's going to be a good one.
That's right.
Have you planted any tomatoes yet?
Don't lie. No.
Okay. I was just wondering.
But I'm still going to beat you this year.
Richie, were you able to stay awake during this podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah. He wants to go dart a bighorn. I
mean, so if any of our listeners might, I mean, we've got, you know, if you listen, if know anything about sleep apnea and could help Richie, we'd appreciate trying to diagnose this problem.
I'm more into the sleep deprivation.
Yeah. So, well, Taxi, you missed it at the beginning, and we don't have time to go back. But so, anybody else got anything to say? Look.
80 minutes in.
Yeah, 80 minutes in. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Mac.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.